to have you listening to America's Web Radio. On the line with me right now, and it's time for the infectious disease program. Sharon Sanders is on the line. Sharon, how are you doing?
Fine. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good for an old man, I guess. We've got some news coming along that the H5N1, I believe, is showing up again in India. Is that correct?
Right. There's been some poultry. I think what people have to remember is that this stuff really never goes away. There's reservoirs in ducks, for sure. Maybe some other birds. Seen some evidence of that. So H5N1 is coming back, except that it never really left.
Well, I think we've talked about that in the past, really.
What?
I think we've talked about that in the past, really.
Right. I think what people don't realize, because why would they know this off the top of their heads, but, you know, most of these viruses are just always circulating. Circulating, mutating, recombining. It's a, you know, the Earth is a big round circle of flu and other viruses and bacteria, etc. And it's constantly here. It just sort of ebbs and flows. And, you know, we're going into the colder seasons in the northern hemispheres, and typically a lot of times we'll see more outbreaks of bird flu then. We've got a couple people that the Indonesians have admitted to, a couple of public health officials, I think a hospital official, admitted there's a couple people there that had tested positive, maybe a third person, we're not sure. Egypt just announced two more cases of H5N1 in people this last couple of weeks. So it's still around. The problem is finding it in people now is a little more difficult because it has some of the same symptoms of the really severe H1N1, where you get the lung involvement and sometimes spitting up of blood in the really severe H1N1 cases. And so in some of these countries where you've got a history of H5N1 in people and you have current H1N1 cases, you know, I don't know if we're really seeing with clarity what's really going on in those places.
Right. Well, it's something that, like you said, it's something that we're going to have to contend with. And also, here we are in the middle of winter, and everybody's back in school now, and H1N1, you think, will have a resurgence, right?
Well, it's a predominant flu, I think, actually, probably in the world now, everywhere. And, of course, you know, we're going into our traditional flu season. No one really knows, you know, what we're going to be facing. Because, of course, no one has a crystal ball. The CDC came out with their stats for the first week in January called the Flu View. If anyone wants to get this, they can just go onto the CDC site and sign up for it. You can get it emailed to you, the notice that it's out. And, of course, they're keeping track. The week ending January 9th, there were 7 influenza-associated pediatric deaths, which is up from 4 from the week before. They're also tracking Tamiflu resistance. They seem to feel that it's more of sort of a hit and miss of resistance throughout the world, but there's been at least, I don't know, 50-something cases that are documented, and I just think that the worldwide distribution of this resistance is so widespread that it looks to me like, you know, we're developing maybe a strain or two that is very resistant, and people should not count on Tamiflu working for them, you know, maybe in the mid-year or, you know, I don't know when, but it's not something people should count on, and that gets us back to the vaccination issue.
You know, which we've talked about numerous times, and your guess this afternoon, who's that going to be?
Well, we're doing something different. Today marks our first bilingual presentation from Flu Trackers. The first 30 minutes is myself, and that'll be English. And then at the half hour, we are having Diane Morin. She runs one of the largest homeless shelters in Quebec. She's a humanitarian of the first degree. Of course, her primary language is French. and she will be getting on and talking about what's going on in Haiti. There's very few outlets that are broadcasting in French or putting out information in French in regards to what's going on down there. Of course, they have it in France and Quebec, but not on the radio so much. And of course, these podcasts are, you can archive them and you can, you know, download them. And she's been finding out where people can get help and what's going on down there. And so we will be broadcasting in French for our second half hour.
Oh, well, I'm glad you let me know. I'm
so,
glad you see the humor in it.
What?
I'm glad you see the humor in it.
Well, that's what happens when you let me do things, and I just, I just go ahead and do them. But she's quite experienced in the needs of people who actually have no house, which is, you know, what's going on down there.
Well, I think the biggest thing that's going on down there, and I guess this is of concern to me, they're talking that there's 100 to 150,000 bodies that they're going to have to dispose of, and I understand that they've started fires now to basically incinerate the bodies. You know, this could turn into, as Michael Daly and I talked, Dr. Daly and I talked several years ago, or many years ago, when we started the show regarding H5N1 and the potential disaster of literally having bodies on the street. So I guess we're looking at Haiti and as an example of what can happen, not necessarily with an earthquake, but with a natural disaster, be it an earthquake or be it H5N1, a pandemic or whatever. And I think Haiti is an example that could even happen in the United States if we had a true multi-phase pandemic that killed 5-10% of the population even.
And, it's just
now I guess my question is,
it's a mind-blowing and astonishing thing. It's just it's just,
well,
the survival there is so tough that it was first, you know, stabilize yourself and your near ones, and
I guess
then
my question is,
you know,
what are they going to bring back from Haiti? What are the people that are there potentially going to be exposed to with the decaying bodies potentially, what are they bringing back to the States?
Well, you know, first of all, there's a lot of myths about bodies. Dead bodies don't really spread disease. I mean, unless, you know, if you're just walking around and you're down there and there's dead bodies, that itself doesn't spread disease.
Well, I realize they're not going to reach out and grab you, but at the same token,
no.
The animals
and earthquakes themselves, by themselves, don't trigger major epidemics. But what you've got is an extremely vulnerable population now that's literally living on the street, many of them. Of course, not in other parts of Haiti, but the capital, Port-au-Prince, is very, very hard hit with, you know, several million people that are just displaced, internally displaced. And so, you know, what are they going to bring back? You know, they have a high rate of AIDS, but what people don't understand is the UN had a presence there of something like, I think, 15,000 people. Of course, they lost several hundred, I believe, they suspect, in the earthquake itself. But there's, you know, the level of help for Haiti in situ has been huge. And so, yes, they're poor. Yes, they, you know, they have the lowest per capita income in this part of the world. But a lot of those diseases are fairly under control there because of the international assistance that's been going on. So, you know, they have a high incidence of AIDS and of tuberculosis, but people know this, and they're aware of it. And so, you know, I wouldn't be afraid of Haitians or people coming from Haiti or anything of the sort at all.
Well, I guess my opinion is time will tell. Obviously, you've got, I agree that a body is not going to cause a disease necessarily, but you have, I just think, depending on how rapidly they can dispose of it and address the situation is going to,
well,
answer
the
a lot
only,
of questions.
The only problem would be, Of course, if it rains and
you got tetanus, you've got you know, a number of other things.
Of course, but you know, tetanus, that these are things in Haiti itself, very dire situation. But in terms of it being, you know, communicable to the rest of the area, the rest of the geographical area, it's very limited. It's just a disaster in Haiti at this point. Mostly because these people are very vulnerable. They're some of them got out with, you know, going without food and water. Some of them have injuries, even slight or superficial injuries can get infected. And of course you have opportunistic infections all the time. And of course there's, you know, circulating viruses, flu for one, and other things. And so, you know, as a population, they're extremely, extremely vulnerable now. But in terms of, you know, them infecting people or, you know, infecting people in that area, that would be a fallacy. That's not really going to happen.
Well, like I said, I guess time will tell and see what happens. It is a tragedy, but your lady, whoever she is calling in or whatever, I feel like some other countries could be stepping up to the plate alongside us, which it's a shame that the world doesn't respond like we do to everything. Unfortunately,
I think they are. I mean, first of all, the regional office of WHO is extremely proactive. It's PAHO, P-A-H-O, and they have a website. You can get on there and take a look. They are on site. That would be, you know, the district area of WHO, which is basically the Americas. Very active, very on site. They're issuing reports of what's going on every day. For instance, today they said that they've gone out to other areas outside of Port-au-Prince now. They're establishing field hospitals, and you know, people need to also understand that the Europeans are kicking in and donating money. And so it is a world effort. I think the EU nations have pledged $575 million for Haiti. And so it's not just, you know, the United States, which would be a perspective from a U.S. citizen's view, but it's the entire world is kicking in money and all showing
and
up there.
Venezuela has given how much?
The EU has pledged $575 million.
No, Venezuela.
Who?
Venezuela.
I don't know that, but the EU, which is the European Union, has pledged $575 million.
And China pledged how much?
I don't know how much China has pledged.
A million.
Well, you know, we're not going to talk about who isn't donating more and what they could donate.
But I think that is indicative of the amount of information you get out of China regarding H1N1 or H5N1 even. And, you know, they were certainly capable of donating more than what they're doing, but that's a whole other story. It would be a shame if at the same time that the cleanup is going on in Haiti that H1N1 appeared.
Well, you know, of course, it's a terrible thing when you have a lot of displaced people. And, of course, I think you did touch on the fact that the Prime Minister of Haiti did announce that he thinks there's probably 200,000 dead there. I think you just said that yesterday.
Well, I'd heard up to 150. I hadn't heard the 200.
Yeah, could be up to 200. They said at the time they had collected, you know, tens of thousands of bodies. And, you know, I guess at some point, going into those buildings, they're so unstable that becomes such a risk for the rescuers that when you get to the point where you know nobody could still be alive, I think they send the dogs in and then, you know, they're just going to, I mean, we'll never know, I guess. They're going to end up probably bulldozing things at some point. And
well,
people will just have disappeared. You just won't know what ever happened to them.
You know, it's the whole thing is totally a shame. And it's unfortunate that a lot of it goes back to their politics, which... again, had they had a better, more stable interest structure than they had, if they'd put rebars in the buildings that they built and a few other things, they could have potentially, it could have been less of a disaster than it was, but that's hindsight, and I guess the thing that concerns me, and it concerns me because of the people there, and that's the corruption in their government. And it's a shame, but that doesn't...
Right. Well, they have a history, a volatile history. I don't know all the politics in the history, but, you know, this goes back to something we've talked about with bird flu, and so not so much with swine flu, but, you know, if it's not staring us in the face, we just ignore it, and we live our little lives, and, you know, we're not... But, you know, when we let a certain segment of the population of the world... live in, I don't know, unsanitary and in squalor conditions. These are situations that are ripe for disease development. And so, you know, we turn our head and we don't look and we don't, you know, as a world, I'm not just saying, you know, the U.S. or anything, but I'm just saying as a world, we allow these conditions to exist to a certain extent. I mean, we help, we send in food, we do these sort of Band-Aid things. But when people don't have clean water out of a well and they don't have sanitary conditions, you know, a lot of these diseases, these extreme versions of these diseases, part of those are developed, and caused by the living conditions of man. And so, you know, Haiti's been down there for a long time. We know, known for a long time that, you know, that it's not run well, that a lot of people are, economically deprived there, then that relates to their health conditions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, so now, literally, I have never seen a disaster, as I'm watching on TV, where there isn't one policeman walking around. There isn't one ambulance walking around.
Well,
there are literally,
I think,
dead bodies in the street, yeah, on the sidewalks.
I tell you, though, there's plenty of blame to go around, but the United States has given over $3 billion in the last 10 years or so, and most of that is probably in offshore banks at this point, and it has never gone to help the people. It's gone to the fat cats that are there to help themselves. And this is where good money.
Well, this
money
is where we can talk about this positive. Is that the Red Cross is doing a great job.
Well, that's good.
If anyone wants to, they are doing news. They're talking about what they're doing down there, and their site is redcross.org. And you know, the money that they get, they're controlling it.
As long as somebody's controlling it, you know, that's fine. So is the I think the Salvation Army and a couple of other organizations. I'd rather see private organizations that have control over it working with them than organizations that have no control. And it's a shame. And I don't know that. Anybody has the answer to, and it's certainly not going to be a quick fix. It's going to take years and years to do anything down there, and it's a shame. You know, it's an amazing. They're talking 200,000 on a 7.0 Richter scale earthquake. Same thing in 83 or 84 that hit San Francisco, and we lost 62 people. So it's very interesting looking at it.
Well, it's a shocking thing. It shows you what happens when there's a building code.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know? There's evidently no building code so much in Haiti, from my understanding. And there's some videos have come out now about what happened when the earthquake happened, and literally things just fell down.
Yeah.
There was,
yeah,
I think, in a more modern looking house, a camera. And they were doing something, and the room started to shake, and then you saw dust and big concrete in that room. And that, you know, I would have never guessed from the beginning of the video that this would be a house that would fall down. So, you know, clearly things need to happen. But it's not the only place in the world where, you know, people are living in conditions that... need to be improved. And I'm just wondering, and you know, I know that the U.S. does donate, et cetera. I'm not, you know, aiming at the United States particularly, but when as a world are we going to look at the vulnerable populations and just say, you know, as long as we let people live like this, as a collective world group, and we don't insist on clean water and sanitation is sort of a bare minimum, and maybe, you know, some other things, you know, these diseases and these tragedies, they just come back to haunt everybody else in the world that's trying to ignore those conditions exist. So, you know, at what point, you know, when is there a collective, and a will that says, you know, if we have the will to provide or help provide clean water to everybody, drinking water, I mean, think of the diseases that we would get rid of just in that way. So,
I think the facts are there, but then you have to be a realist and realize that the UN's a joke. And many of the large organizations are basically incompetent of doing anything. We have other situations that are as critical, if not more so, and yet you can't get world cooperation from everybody on anything. And
I think, you know, some organizations are more effective than others. It does look like organizations like the Red Cross and some of these large nonprofit groups are very effective.
They may be effective in their areas, but they can't make Russia or they can't make China give when they're not going to give. So there's
right,
you know,
right.
It ain't going to happen.
In the end, we can only do it.
Other people
think,
well, other people can't. We can't
right.
sustain everybody. That's just
right,
unfortunately
right. Well,
we can't.
And then in our own lives, we can only do what we can do.
That's it.
It's just a shame, though, when you know, with the advent of technology now, you know, you can see things like an earthquake and then all these bodies laying around. And that's a sort of a shocking thing, and maybe that will, I don't know, wake up the consciousness of some of some groups, or maybe it won't.
It's unfortunate, but I don't think it will, and it's a shame that it had to happen. It's a shame, you know, it wouldn't have been any less terrible to have happened in Britain or in France.
Absolutely.
Or any place else.
It's still a
disaster. But the only thing that good that can come out of it, if there can be any good, and that is preparedness and learning from mistakes that were made. I just you know, I don't know, and perhaps it's a good training area. I know that an organization that I'm fairly well aware of that has a number of the blow-up hospitals was dispatched down there with their blow-up triage operation. So, you know, I think we're doing all we can do. It will be curious to see if it does have ultimately some type of worldwide effect coming out of Haiti. And you're on one side of the street, I'm on the other side of the street, and I'm thinking we could have a real potential problem there. Not, like you said, I agree totally with you, not from, quote, end quote, today's dead body. It's what happens to today's dead body 2 weeks from now. If it's still around, then we're going to start having some problems.
Well, I think there's enough aid going in there now that's not going to be a long-term, I mean, I don't think you're going to be seeing that in any kind of, you know, weak reference point in weeks. I don't think you're going to see that because the international aid groups that are going in there, they're not going to, you know, they're not letting those things sit around. So hopefully the only problem I see is that, you know, they're doing it so fast, there's no documentation of, you know, who's getting buried and who is that person. And they are fairly quickly, digging and disposing of the bodies in mass graves. And so I think that's sort of a sad thing for all of the, you know, the near ones of those people. But at this point, I think that's probably what
I don't think there's a choice.
You know. Well, at some point, you're right. I mean, if the living, you know, the living have to, fortunately, come first. And if there's nobody around to document who's being buried, then I guess that's unfortunately what happens.
And the displacement is terrible, and they're just all sorts of terrible things. There's nothing good. They're going to have to, start bulldozing soon. They're going to have to blow the whistle when they feel like you're right, no other survivors, and then the assumptions have to be made. And all of that's tough. It's not an easy trigger to pull. But again, like I said, if anything comes out of this, it
Well, we hopefully
were talking
about
preparedness
that.
Lesson.
We were talking about that in H5N1, for instance, a year ago or so. If there was a flu pandemic that had a case fatality rate, a very high one, and of course H5N1 has had a high one in the past, you would be looking at a situation where, there would not be enough facilities or apparatus for the numbers of deaths that might occur. And there was quite a bit of discussion in the local cities and governments about when the funeral directors and organizations would become overwhelmed, what would the municipalities do? And a lot of them were talking about where they might place a mass grave, and a lot of them had ordered, had put on a notice and had planned for refrigeration trucks and those kinds of things. In Cortina there was some problems with that, and I think they ended up getting some refrigeration trucks and putting them in Baton Rouge, and so it's an issue. It's an issue when the death rate goes up even slightly. It becomes a catastrophe if the death, you have a great number of deaths all of a sudden.
Well, it's certainly something. Like I said, hopefully some good will come out of it. If nothing else, hello. I think that Sharon, we just lost Sharon. What we're going to do is we'll drop that and we'll do this. And I don't know exactly what happened to Sharon. She must have touched the button and there she went. We're going to take a break. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bo Kirkwood, and I practice family medicine in the Houston area for over 26 years. A few months ago, I was introduced to a holographic pain-relieving chip by a young man I'd coached in Little League Baseball 16 years ago. Skeptically, I tried the chip on my right knee, and amazingly, the pain I had experienced for the past 2 years was significantly improved in hours and gone within weeks. And although the chip does not heal or cure, the pain relief was remarkable, and I will continue to wear the chip. To find out more about this product, go to americaswebradio.com and click on the pain relief button. It works for me, and it just might help your pain problem as well. I'm Dr. Bo Kirkwood. Thank you for your time.
Want to make yourself feel really good today and make someone else thousands of miles away feel even better? Then go to our website and click I Support the Troops. And as they say, read all about it. Do it. And we guarantee it will make you feel great.
Learn about non-invasive pain relief by going to www.americaswebradio.com and clicking on Pain Relief. You'll also find an answer to insomnia and energy assistance. Don't put it off a minute longer if you suffer from chronic pain.
Concord Pharmacies have been serving the greater Atlanta area for over 25 years and has 11 locations in medical building and near hospitals to better serve you. We work closely with your physician to optimize your personal health strategy. Concord has emphasized the utmost importance of the physician-patient-pharmacist relationship. Do not assume because we are not a national chain that we are not competitive. Concord provides competitive pricing and your copay for your prescriptions is the same as at other stores. Concord Pharmacies also provide several services not found at other pharmacies. 1. We provide you with hard-to-find medications. 2. Concord prides itself in customized compounding for medications not commercially available. For more information, call 770-671-0657 or go to our website, www.concord-pharmacy.net.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Okay, and back, and hopefully she won't hit the button again, is Sharon, and she's got her guest on the line. So, Sharon, I'm going to turn it over to you, and I'll be back in about 27 minutes.
Okay, merci. J'ai le privilège de vous présenter Madame Diane Morin du Flu Trackers et le Archipel des Entrades. Il est le directeur de notre forum de français et nous représentant à Québec. Bienvenue, Diane.
Bien, merci beaucoup, Sharon. Merci aussi à David de m'avoir invité. Alors, bonsoir aux auditeurs et aux auditrices. Ce soir, je vais vous parler un peu là de ce que moi j'ai pu lire et documenter depuis mardi soir dernier concernant le terrible séisme qui s'est passé à Haïti. Cette documentation-là est placée sur le forum francophone de Flu Trackers et il n'y a pas seulement que moi là, qui contribue. Alors, je voudrais souligner les contributions de Lily, de Sharon, de Iron O'Roper, de Pat Fender, de Alaska Denise, de Thornton, de Michel et ainsi que de Anne. J'aborderai quelques points. Et je vais commencer tout de suite en parlant d'abord de l'évaluation de l'ampleur du sinistre à Haïti. Alors, le bilan des morts est assez difficile à établir, même si on est 6 jours après le sinistre. On parle actuellement de 75 000 corps qui ont été enterrés, et ça, c'est de sources selon le gouvernement haïtien. Les chiffres de 150 000 à 200 000 morts sont parfois évoqués, mais il faut comprendre que ce sont des hypothèses de travail. Donc, les chiffres changent. Alors, le nombre réel de personnes qui sont enterrées et parfois ce sont plus des estimations. Les villes les plus touchées sont bien sûr Port-au-Prince, la capitale, qui est peuplé autour de 3 millions d'habitants. On a vu beaucoup d'images de Port-au-Prince, mais depuis la fin de semaine, on voit aussi les images des villes de Léogane, qui est à l'ouest de la capitale, qui est endommagée, celle-là, à près de 90%. C'est terrible, la situation à Léogane. Ce serait la zone la plus touchée, on parle là de l'épicentre du séisme. Actuellement, la police locale fait état là, entre 5 et 10 000 personnes qui seraient mortes à Léogane sur un total de 134 000 habitants. Les équipes de sauveteurs ont aussi atteint les villes de Gressier, 25 000 habitants, et de Carrefour qui est tout proche là de Port-au-Prince et dans la banlieue de Port-au-Prince. On parle là d'une ville de 334 000 habitants. Et dans les deux cas, on parle d'environ 40 à 50 de destruction des bâtiments et beaucoup de victimes, évidemment. D'autres villes encore ont été touchées. Alors, tout récemment, là, on apprenait là, pour ce qui est de Jacmel, une ville qui est au sud, qui compte 30 000 habitants, qui est détruite, elle aussi, environ à moitié, selon ce qu'on peut lire là, dans les journaux. Pour ce qui est de Petit Goave, et de Grand Goave, on a appris là des tristes nouvelles là. On n'avait pas de nouvelles, mais maintenant on en a. Alors, ce sont des villes aussi qui sont touchées. Petit Goave compte 120 000 habitants. Vous comprendrez là qu'on n'a pas encore de décompte là des morts là-bas. Et Grand Goave est une ville d'environ 50 000 habitants. On a appris aujourd'hui qu'il y avait deux personnes d'origine québécoise qui étaient décédées là-bas. Les Nations Unies, eux, estiment que 3 millions de personnes ont été touchées là, par le tremblement de terre et que 300 000 sont sans abri. L'Organisation internationale des migrations, l'OIM, estime à 200 000 familles qui, jusqu'à maintenant, ont besoin là, de trouver un abri d'urgence. Alors, la situation est très vaste. C'est beaucoup de personnes là, à secourir. Et si on parle justement des secours, alors, au cours des premières journées, c'est la première phase de secours qui était en opération. Alors, on parle là de 27 équipes internationales de sauveteurs, qui comptait environ 1500 professionnels, 115 chiens qui ont été déployés sur le terrain et selon là, le département d'État américain. Des recherches ont eu lieu dans environ 60% des quartiers de Port-au-Prince, mais ce n'est pas le cas pour les autres villes dont j'ai parlé tantôt. On a retrouvé 70 personnes qui ont été sauvées là, des décombres. Parallèlement à ça, les secours se sont aussi organisés pour établir des ponts, un pont aérien, et avec beaucoup de difficultés sur l'aéroport de Port-au-Prince. Et il a fallu ajouter à cela un autre pont, mais là, cette fois-ci terrestre, entre la République dominicaine et Port-au-Prince. C'est ce que l'ONU préconise actuellement, que l'aide humanitaire, les convois d'aide humanitaire partent de Saint-Domingue pour se rendre en Haïti, à Port-au-Prince et aussi dans les autres villes environnantes qui ont été touchées. Quand on regarde les images à la télévision, aussi les reportages écrits, on voit bien que l'aide a été difficile à acheminer aux personnes sur le terrain. Ces personnes ont besoin de soins médicaux, ont besoin d'eau potable et d'aide alimentaire ainsi que d'abri essentiellement. Et actuellement, on sait que le Programme alimentaire mondial a fait un appel pour débloquer environ 300 millions de dollars pour distribuer des rations alimentaires à 2 millions de personnes pendant 6 mois. On a appris aussi aujourd'hui, en fait hier soir, que allait s'ouvrir 280 centres d'urgence qui devaient ouvrir à partir d'aujourd'hui pour distribuer les vivres et héberger les sans-abri. On a bien vu aussi par les images à la télévision que les distributions soient parachutées ou les distributions dans les points uniques défavorisaient les personnes qui sont malades, les personnes âgées, les femmes avec enfants. Alors ce qu'on voyait à la télévision, c'était pratiquement seulement que des jeunes hommes là, qui pouvaient atteindre ces vivres. Alors c'est une grande avancée là, ces centres d'urgence qui vont être ouverts par le gouvernement haïtien, mais aidé bien sûr là de l'aide internationale. Par ailleurs, l'Agence américaine d'aide au développement dispose actuellement là, de 7 tonnes de nourriture déjà sur place à Haïti, selon le département d'État. Et les États-Unis, eux, ont fourni à date 87 millions de dollars en aide humanitaire. Les forces américaines ont apporté des rations là, de nourriture journalière. Ils en ont parachuté aussi et ont distribué aussi 70 000 bouteilles d'eau et comme je disais, là, 130 000 rations de nourriture journalière. On sait aussi qu'un navire commercial transportant de la farine et de l'huile végétale était attendu aujourd'hui au port des Cayes, à quelques 160 km au sud-ouest de Port-au-Prince. La cargaison devrait permettre, selon les calculs américains, de satisfaire les besoins de 130 000 personnes pendant 30 jours. Alors, c'est un petit peu un aperçu de l'aide qui est apportée pour les vivres et l'eau. Maintenant, je vais détailler plus en détail, justement, pour ce qui est des soins médicaux. Alors, je vais faire le tour des hôpitaux qui offrent actuellement des services. Alors, on a appris là, par les rapports de l'OMS que plusieurs hôpitaux avaient été endommagés lors du tremblement de terre et qu'il y en avait 5 qui fonctionnaient toujours. Alors, on parle de l'hôpital Saint-Esprit, de l'hôpital Pierre-Damiens, de la clinique de l'hôpital Le Messie, le nouveau ventre médical, ainsi que l'hôpital militaire argentin. Dans les 8 hôpitaux qui, eux, ont été endommagés, souvent grandement endommagés et même plusieurs effondrés, des équipes soit de Médecins sans frontières, la Croix-Rouge, Médecins du Monde se sont mis à la tâche et ont réouvert soit à l'intérieur des hôpitaux ou dans les cours adjacentes des hôpitaux, plusieurs de ces hôpitaux. Alors, je vais en faire là, la nomenclature. J'oubliais, pardon, qu'il y avait aussi le King's Hospital qui est situé le long de la route de terre de la petite place Cazaux à Port-au-Prince, qui était toujours ouvert. C'est un hôpital financé qui est tenu, pardon, par un Haïtien, mais financé là, par des donateurs américains. Également, pour les patients qui souffrent du VIH-SIDA, il y a une installation là qui est ouverte, c'est le GESCIO, qui se situe au 33 boulevard Harry Truman à Port-au-Prince. Alors ça aussi, c'était toujours ouvert. Maintenant, je reviens avec les hôpitaux qui ont réouvert en cours de route. Alors on parle d'abord de l'hôpital général dans le quartier Delmas. À cet endroit, c'est les équipes là, de Médecins du Monde qui ont réouvert dimanche là, l'hôpital. On parle ici là, d'équipe chirurgicale qui est opérationnelle, en fait, depuis samedi à l'hôpital général qui était à semi-détruit. Et à cet endroit, il y a aussi là, de l'aide là, de d'autres ONG là, sur place. Mais l'hôpital est quand même débordé. On l'a vu, cet hôpital, souvent dans les reportages, et c'est un endroit où la morgue est pleine, où il y a des corps là, qui pourrissent sur le sol. Alors, c'est une situation quand même difficile. Ensuite, il y a les hôpitaux qui sont tenus ou qui étaient tenus par Médecins sans frontières. Alors, on parle de l'hôpital Choscal qui est situé dans Cité-Soleil, qui est réouvert aussi, là, Cité-Soleil, qui est le grand bidonville là, de Port-au-Prince. Alors, c'est réouvert. Je pense que c'est à côté de l'hôpital. Ensuite, l'hôpital de la Trinité, qui est dans le quartier Delmas 19, à cet endroit-là aussi, Médecins sans frontières on continue de donner des services. Il s'agit là de services qui sont donnés dans la cour de l'hôpital. Il y a aussi là, des services qui se donnent au centre de réhabilitation Pachot, qui est à côté là, de l'hôpital de la Trinité, qui est un hôpital qui est spécialisé en traumatologie. Alors, c'est très important. Dans Carrefour aussi, Médecins sans frontières ont réouvert des cliniques et également à l'hôpital Adventiste de Déquigny, toujours dans Carrefour. À cet endroit-là, ce n'est pas Médecins sans frontières, mais c'est un autre point dans Carrefour où il y a des services. Ensuite, quand on lit l'actualité, on voit qu'il y a beaucoup d'équipes internationales qui acheminent de l'aide de l'aide médicale et aussi qui transportent des hôpitaux de campagne. Alors, il y a un grand hôpital qui est ouvert depuis hier, un grand hôpital de campagne israélien qui a commencé à soigner, alors avec, 60 lits, c'est à Port-au-Prince. De même que l'hôpital de campagne américain a ouvert dimanche. Et le navire hôpital américain devrait arriver jeudi. Et on apprend aussi que l'hôpital de campagne français devrait commencer à offrir des services incessamment. Celui-ci, l'hôpital de campagne français, va être situé dans le jardin qui est attenant à l'ambassade. L'ambassade qui est située sur la rue Capois à Port-au-Prince, alors 51 rue Capois. Ensuite, il y a aussi l'hôpital, un autre hôpital qui est en route de Médecins sans frontières. Et il y en a également un hôpital russe qui serait ouvert, mais je ne sais pas du tout où. Et donc, beaucoup d'hôpitaux qui se mettent en place. Et on pense que dans ceux qui vont s'en venir, il y en aura aussi là pour les autres villes qui sont touchées. Et je pense que l'équipe canadienne sera à Jacmel. À Jacmel, justement, il y a des personnes là qui se sont rassemblées là sur deux terrains, les terrains de foot dans un cas et le terrain aussi Wolf. C'est pour entre les auditeurs qui nous écoutent, tout ce qui s'appelle terrain public, les terrains de football, les stades, c'est des endroits qui sont visés là pour les secours. Alors, c'est des endroits à fréquenter. Un point qui est important quand on fait face à un aussi terrible tremblement de terre qui a des conséquences sur la santé, évidemment, les principales conséquences sont bien sûr là tous les risques des personnes qui ont été coincées sous les décombres, alors des blessures non traitées, des traumatismes, des infections aux plaies, des risques sanitaires aussi qui sont liés à des maladies infectieuses. On parle de la diarrhée, qui sont liés aux maladies infectieuses, mais aussi là, au manque d'eau potable. Alors, les zoonoses telles que la rage, les morsures de serpents, etc., peuvent constituer aussi une menace. Et bien sûr, on comprendra aussi que tous les dommages qui ont été causés aux installations de santé vont affecter les personnes qui recevaient là des soins avant le tremblement de terre. Alors c'était là les problèmes majeurs de santé qui ont été identifiés par l'OMS. Dans les problèmes de santé dont on parle pas toujours, il y a aussi les problèmes de santé mentale. Et on sait que les problèmes de santé mentale apparaissent une fois que les gens, que la situation individuelle des gens là, se rétablisse. Alors, bien sûr, là, sur le coup, il y a un choc, il y a un sentiment de confusion, de peur, d'agitation, du chagrin, de la colère, etc. Mais il peut y avoir aussi là des chocs post-traumatiques, des troubles psychologiques qui vont apparaître après, quand les besoins, quand les gens vont se sentir là, hors de danger. Alors, ce sont des séquelles qui peuvent être graves et on recommande aux gens là de demander de l'aide quand cela se produit. Les gens ont besoin aussi d'informations pour... c'est très très difficile de vivre ces situations-là sans avoir l'information. Alors, c'est des recommandations, ça, qui ont été faites après l'ouragan Katrina, de pousser l'information vers les gens pour que les gens aient l'information et que cela peut atténuer les rumeurs et atténuer aussi l'anxiété des personnes. Ces problèmes psychologiques touchent non seulement les personnes sur place à Haïti, mais vont également, et ça, on se prépare à ça, vont toucher aussi les personnes qui sont à l'étranger. Alors, on parle là, des Haïtiens, dans les communautés haïtiennes à l'étranger. On parle des États-Unis, du Canada, de la France, mais aussi d'autres pays, mais c'est surtout ceux-là que j'ai documenté. Alors, on recommande à ces personnes-là de se réunir pour pouvoir parler et ne pas vivre ça isolé. vivre cette grande impuissance là et isolée. Alors c'est ce qu'on a remarqué là qui s'est produit à Paris. La communauté haïtienne compte environ 40 000 personnes et les gens se sont rassemblés. Il y a eu un rassemblement au Trocadéro en fin de semaine et les gens l'ont fait là pour pouvoir justement là parler et s'échanger de l'information, mais aussi pour faire des revendications à leur gouvernement. Et la même chose s'est passée aussi à Montréal. Montréal, en tout cas le Québec compte beaucoup de Haïtiens. Ils sont surtout situés à Montréal. Le chiffre pour l'ensemble du Québec, c'est plus de 50 000 là, Haïtiens. Et à Montréal, les gens, dès le début là des annonces concernant le tremblement de terre, les gens se sont rassemblés à la Perle retrouvée, qui est une association culturelle haïtienne dans le quartier Saint-Michel. D'ailleurs, les journalistes québécois et les politiciens ont visité la communauté haïtienne là-bas, à la Perle retrouvée. Et dans les discussions, les Haïtiens de Montréal ont commencé à faire des pressions là, sur le gouvernement québécois et canadien pour créer là, des foyers d'hébergement temporaire pour les victimes du séisme, qui a dévasté là, leur pays d'origine. Et c'est l'organisme communautaire qui s'appelle, que je retrouve l'information, qui s'appelle Comité Participation Haïti-Québec-Canada, qui s'est formé et qui fait là, les pressions là, pour obtenir une plus grande ouverture à l'immigration de la part du Canada. Je n'ai pas tous les détails, mais je sais qu'il y a une forte communauté haïtienne à Miami, à New York, dans d'autres villes aussi, Boston. Là-bas aussi, à Miami, on a vu, en tout cas d'après ce que j'ai vu, là, des rassemblements là, d'Haïtiens d'origine dans Little Haïti. Et il y a eu là aussi là une forme d'organisation là de collecte de vivres, de vêtements, de médicaments et aussi des concerts bénéfices. À New York, il y a beaucoup d'Haïtiens d'origine. J'ai pas les chiffres exacts, mais c'est plusieurs centaines de milliers d'Haïtiens, notamment dans Brooklyn. Et là, la communauté haïtienne s'est réunie dans les bars et aussi là, dans les restaurants là, pour échanger, partager leurs souffrances et leurs informations. Autre point qui faisait partie des éléments que nous voulions parler, je voulais peut-être vous donner un peu des nouvelles là, pour ce qui est du rapatriement des ressortissants étrangers. Alors, pour les États-Unis, j'ai pas de chiffres à jour, j'en avancerai pas. Les auditeurs le savent probablement mieux que moi. Mais pour ce qui est du Canada, on parle d'environ 600 personnes qui ont été évacuées à l'heure actuelle. Pour la France, ce matin, on parlait de 600. Et au niveau des Européens, on parlait de 20 personnes. Alors, il y a beaucoup de travail à faire de ce côté-là aussi. Et on a appris là aujourd'hui que la communauté européenne a demandé à la France d'aider au rapatriement des autres pays européens, notamment pour ce qui est des Italiens. Un autre souci concernait la communauté libanaise en Haïti, qui compte, d'après ce que j'ai vu, 15 000 personnes. Alors, on n'a pas de nouvelles de qu'est-ce qui est arrivé à ces personnes. Alors, c'est un souci là pour notamment là pour les autorités libanaises. Il y a des lueurs d'espoir quand on regarde ce qui se fait. En tout cas, les communautés se démènent, les communautés haïtiennes se démènent, mais aussi les gouvernements des pays étrangers. On voit un élan de sympathie et un élan d'aide vers Haïti comme on n'en a jamais vu. La Croix-Rouge canadienne pour sa section Montréal a amassé en date d'hier 25 millions de dollars pour aider Haïti. On sait que le gouvernement canadien va mettre le même montant que l'aide qui est octroyée par les citoyens. Alors, va doubler l'aide. Et ça, on parle juste de la Croix-Rouge canadienne. Il y a d'autres aussi, d'autres grandes organisations qui collectent et qui font très bien dans les résultats aussi. Et ça, c'est comme ça pour le Québec, pour le Canada, pour les États-Unis. On sait que Barack Obama a demandé l'aide de Bill Clinton et de George W. Bush pour lever d'importantes sommes pour venir en aide à Haïti. C'est partout et on a vu quelque chose de très touchant aussi. Je tiens à le dire, peut-être que le message passera à travers ma voix. Le président du Sénégal a offert aux Haïtiens qui le voudraient de pouvoir émigrer au Sénégal et offrirait, en tout cas c'est la promesse qui est faite, des lopins de terre, et même si le nombre de personnes est important, si le nombre est important, le Sénégal pourrait offrir là, une région au complet là, aux réfugiés haïtiens. Alors, c'était un peu ce qui ressortait de nos lectures, de ce que nous avons ramassé sur Flow Trackers. Il y avait aussi des recommandations pour le personnel de santé et de secours. En gros, j'y vais très rapidement parce que l'heure avance. Avant de se lancer vers Haïti, il faut s'assurer que les vaccinations sont à jour. Alors, pour la rubéa, l'orion, rougeole, tous les vaccins là, réguliers, diphtérie, coqueluche, tétanos, poliomyélite. La CDC recommande également le vaccin contre la grippe saisonnière, contre le H1N1, contre l'hépatite A, la typhoïde. Le personnel de santé et les humanitaires doivent faire attention à la transmission là, des maladies par les insectes. On parle surtout là, du paludisme et de la dengue, mais aussi de d'autres maladies infectieuses telles que le VIH. Alors, c'est très important de porter des gants. Faire attention également à la tuberculose et passer des tests avant de partir et après, 6 à 8 semaines après. Faire attention à l'anthrax. Se préparer mentalement et physiquement, etc., à une infrastructure sur place qui est inexistante. Alors, il faut veiller à la salubrité des aliments, éviter le contact avec les animaux, prendre garde aux autres risques liés aux états de catastrophe tels que l'électrocution, les fuites de gaz, la manipulation des cadavres. Et ça fait un peu le tour là, de ce que j'avais ramassé pour vous. Permettez-moi de dire au peuple haïtien que ici au Québec, on est tous haïtiens de cœur. Et je vous souhaite bonne chance là, pour tout le relèvement et la guérison.
Sharon, we're going to have to call it a day, I'm afraid. Sharon?
Yes, we're here.
Okay, well, we're going to have to call it a day, and we appreciate your guest. And,
merci, Diane.
Merci beaucoup, Sharon. Merci, David.
Bye-bye.
Gracias.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you later. You're listening to America's Web Radio. We're glad to have you listening in. Stay tuned next for Your Eyes with Dr. Andrew Schatz. We'll be back after a couple of messages.